What part of it did he see first? That we know with some precision. The circumstances show it. The route which the Ishmaelites took him was dictated to them in more than one way, and by the lie of the land besides. It is as certain as it is ever little commented on that the part of Egypt to which Joseph first came was one which is known and even famous not because of the role it played in the history of Egypt, but on account of its connection with the story of Jacob and his family. It was the land of Goshen. It was called Goshen, or Goshen, indifferently, according to the speaker's enunciation, and belonged to the district of Arabia, the 20th of the land of Uto the serpent, that is to say, Lower Egypt. It lay in the eastern part of the delta, wherefore Joseph and his guides entered it so soon as they had left the salt inland seas and frontier fortifications behind. There was certainly nothing great or remarkable about it. Joseph did not find himself in any danger of losing his head or being hampered by awe at the importunate marvels of Mizraim. Wild geese flew across a mild, dull, rainy sky above the monotonous marshland, threaded with ditches and dikes, out of which here and there rose a single blackthorn or a mulberry fig tree. The travelers went on causeways, following the watercourses, where long-legged birds, storks and ibises, stood in the canebrake that choked the streams. Whole villages mirrored the cone-shaped clay roofs of their storehouses and the shade of their doom palms, fan-shaped leaves, in the green duck ponds beside them. They were not different to the eye from villages in the homeland, and not a very rewarding sight after a journey of 7 times 17 days. It was simple earthland that Joseph saw, without any surprising features. It was not even the granary of the well-known phrase, for what he saw was simply grassland and pastureland far and wide, though to be sure the pasturage was lush and well-watered. The son of shepherds looked with interest at it. Many flocks grazed over it, cattle, white and red, either hornless or with upstanding lyre-shaped horns. There were sheep, too. Their shepherds had made shelters from the drizzling rain by stretching papyrus mats above their crooks, and squatted underneath with their jackal-eared dogs. The cattle, the old man instructed his followers, were mostly not from these parts. They came from far upstream, and belonged to the landowners and the overseers of the temple stables in regions where there was hardly anything but arable land, and the cattle would have had to feed on the clover fields. So at the right time of year, the herds were sent down into the fenny districts of northern Lower Egypt to batten on the meadows made luxuriant by these very freshwater canals along which our little train was now passing. They led it straight to Persopt, the original holy city of the district, for there the ditch branched off from the delta arm of Hapi and connected the river with the Bitter Lakes. These, as the old man knew, were in turn united by a canal with the Sea of the Red Earth, otherwise the Red Sea, so that one could pass straight on through from the Nile and sail from the city of Amun to the incense land of Punt, as at once the bold ships of Hatshepsut, the woman who had been Pharaoh and worn the beard of Osiris. As they went on, the old man continued to prattle about all these traditional matters in his shrewd and easy-going way. But Joseph listened uncomfortably, and had no ear at all for the doings of Hatshepsut, that woman whose sex had been changed by the dignity of the kingship so that she had worn the beard. Shall I be saying too much if I set down how his fancy flung an airy bridge between the gay meadows here and his kin at home, his father and little Benjamin? Surely not, even though his thinking may not have been of the same kind as ours, but played about a few dream motifs which formed, as it were, the musical fabric of his mental life. One of these had always been closely related to the thoughts of being snatched away and lifted up, the motif of being followed after. Then there was another contradictory one in his changeful play of thought, which concerned Jacob's dislike of the country whither he was snatched. He harmonized the two contrapuntally by telling himself that this peacefully primeval pastureland here might indeed be already Egypt, but after all was not the real Egypt, therefore not utterly abhorrent, and that it might appeal to Jacob, the king of many flocks, who found it hard to sustain them at home. He looked at the grazing herd sent hither by Upper Egyptian proprietors to feed on the fat of the land, and had a lively feeling that the motif of being snatched away needed completion by that of being lifted up, before the flocks of the lords of the upper river would make way for other flocks in the land of Goshen. In other words, before the motif of being followed after could come in. He weighed afresh his conviction and strengthened himself mightily in it, that if one were indeed going to the west, at least one must become the first of those who were there. For the present, however, he went with his masters along the flat, clayey margin of the beneficent watercourse, dotted here and there with spindling palms. On the smooth water, a flotilla of boats was slowly gliding eastward with monstrously tall sails on swaying masts. By this route, they could not miss the holy city Persopdu, which, when they reached it, proved to be a huddled settlement surrounded by disproportionately high walls, but with little life inside them. For almost the whole population consisted of the presiding field judge and privy bearer of the king's command, who bore the good Syrian title of Rabisu, together with his officials and the shorn priesthood of the regional god Sopd, called Scourge of the Dwellers of Sinai. Among the rest of the inhabitants, the colored Asiatic dress and the language of Amor and Zehai were much more in evidence than the white Egyptian garb and the Egyptian tongue. The narrow streets of Persopd smelt so strong of carnations or clove pinks that at first it was pleasant and then painful, for this was the incense most favored of Sopdu in his temple, and every offering reeked of it. This Sopdu was so old, so ancient a god, that his own priests and prophets, who wore lynx skins on their backs and went about with their eyes cast down, no longer knew for a certainty whether his head was that of a pig or a hippopotamus. He was a god rejected and obscure, embittered thereby, to judge from the mood and language of his priests. For a long time now he had not been the scourge of the dwellers in Sinai. His image, only hand high, stood in the remotest part of his primitive and very clumsy temple, whose courts and antechambers were adorned with extremely ungainly seated images of the early pharaoh who had built the temple. The foremost gatehouse, with its buttressed, picture-covered walls, had little niches, in each of which stood a gilded flagpole flying a gay pennant. But all this strove in vain to give blitheness to the house of Sopd. It was poorly endowed, the treasuries and storehouses round the main court stood empty, and not many people waited on Sopdu with offerings. Only the Egyptian inhabitants, and none from elsewhere. And there was no feast of general observance to draw zealous pilgrims down river and within the crumbling walls of Persopd. The Ishmaelites, as a business gesture, laid on the offertory in the square hall a few nosegays which they found for sale in the open court, also a duck spiced with cloves. They talked to the shiny-pated priests with long fingernails and forever downcast gaze, and from them heard in heavy accents of the fallen state of their aboriginal lord and his city. They complained of the times, which brought great injustice with them, and heaped all the power, splendor, and precedence in one side of the balance of the lands, namely, in the southern or upper part, since when it was that Waysay had grown so great, whereas originally they had piously weighed down the northern or lower land of the delta, as was right and just. For in the good old times, when Mempi had been the brilliant city of kings, the delta region had been the real and true Egypt, and the upper parts, including Thebes, had ranked almost with the wretched Kush and the Negro countries. Then the south had been poor in culture and enlightenment, as well as in beauty of life. From the ancient north, these blessings had spread fruitfully southwards up the river. Here were the sources of knowledge, civilization, and prosperity. Here the most venerable gods of the land had had their birth, as, for instance, Sopd, the Lord of the East in his chapel, whom now a wrong adjustment of the balance had put quite in the shade. For Theban Amun, up there near the Negro lands, set itself up today as a judge of what was to be considered Egyptian and what not, convinced that its name spelled Egypt, and Egypt Thebes. A little time ago, said the embittered temple treaders, people of the West living near the Libyans had even sent to Amun and represented to him that it seemed to them they were Libyans too, and not Egyptians, for they lived outside the delta, and agreed in nothing with the children of Egypt, either in service of the gods or otherwise. They loved, so they said, the flesh of cows, and wanted freedom to eat it, as did the Libyans, whose like they were. But Amun had answered and reproved them. There could be no talk of the flesh of cows, for all that land was Egypt, which was fertilized by the Nile, up and downstream, and all were Egyptians who dwelt this side of the city of elephants and drank from the river. Thus Amun's judgment. The priests of the Lord Soptu lifted their long-nailed hands as they strove to make clear to the Ishmaelites the arrogance of it. Why, then, they scornfully asked, this side of Shab and the first cataract? Just because Thebes lay this side? If Sopt, their lord, down here in the north, in the first and genuine land of Egypt, were to declare that everything was Egyptian that drank from the river, it would be a broad and high-minded thing to say. But when Amun said it, a god who, to speak mildly, stood under suspicion of Nubian origin and of being originally a god of the wretched Cush, who had achieved primacy in the mind of the peoples only by arbitrarily putting himself on a par with Atum Re, then there was something lacking in his broad-mindedness, and you could not call it high-minded at all. In short, the prophets of Sopt suffered from jealousy and peevishness at the eclipse of their god through time and events, and the Ishmaelites, the old man at their head, humored them like the good men of business that they were. Also they increased their offerings with sundry loaves of bread and jugs of beer, and showed the neglected Sopt all due attention before they went on to Per Bastet close by. The City of Cats. And here it smelt so strong of catnip that it almost turned a stranger's stomach, for the odor is offensive to everybody, save only to the sacred animal of Bastet, namely the cat, which is well known to love it. Numerous specimens of the animal were kept in Bastet's shrine, the city's mighty core. Black, white, and colored, they frisked with the stealthy and persistent charm of their species among the worshippers in the court, and were flattered with offerings of the hateful herb. But cats were everywhere in Per Bastet, in all the private houses as well, and the smell of valerian pervaded everything. It even flavored the food and lingered in men's garments, so that when they went as far as On and Mempi, they were greeted with laughter and the words, "You come from Per Bastet, don't you?" The laughter had not to do with the smell alone, but with the cat city itself and its associations, which were matter enough for mirth. For Per Bastet, unlike Per Sopt, which it exceeded in size and population, had a reputation for gaiety. It even looked jolly, although lying so deep in the ancient delta, its jollity being of a primitive, coarse-fibred kind, which made all Egypt laugh whenever it thought of it. This city, also therein, unlike the shrine of Sopt, had a feast of general observance. Its citizens boasted that millions, that is, certainly tens of thousands of people, came downriver by land or water to attend it. Even on the way thither they got very jolly. The women especially, equipped with rattles, behaved with roguish abandon, according to all accounts, and words and gestures of a decidedly primitive character were flung across from the decks of their boats to the villages on the shore. The men, too, were jolly. They whistled, sang, and clapped, and all of the visitors held great press of popular meetings in Per Bastet, camping in tents for a 3 days' feast, with sacrifices, dances, and mummery to the dull rolling of drums, with a fair, storytelling, juggling, snake-charming, and more grape wine than was drunk otherwise in Per Bastet in all the rest of the year. We are told that the mood of the people so passed over into the primitive that they even flagellated themselves, or rather beat themselves till it hurt, with a sort of thorny club, amid general bawling. And this bawling was an inseparable feature of the primitive feast. Indeed, it was what made people laugh when they thought of Bastet, for it sounded just like the nocturnal caterwauling of the female at the visit of the male cat. With all these matters, then, the inhabitants regaled the strangers and boasted of the profitable crowds which enlivened once every year an otherwise uneventful life. The old man, on business grounds, regretted that he had not come at the right time of year for the feast. His young slave, Usarsif, listened to the narration with apparently respectful eyes, nodded politely, and thought of Jacob. Of him he thought, and of the templeless god of his fathers, as he stood at the highest part of the city and looked down through its middle depth where two tree-shaded branches of water embraced the sacred peninsula, into the dwelling of the female idol, enclosed in towering walls. The main building lay inside a hedge of old sycamore trees. Its pylons were thick with images. Its courts were shaded by awnings, and the roofs of its colorful halls were borne by columns whose capitals imitated the open and closed calyxes of the Byblus reed. It lay there spacious and extended, accessible by the stone-paved road from the east by which he had come in the Ishmaelite train. He continued to think, when later he entered the temple walls and looked at the pictures graven on the walls and painted deep red and sky blue. Pharaoh burning incense before the cat goddess, among incredibly clear inscriptions of eyes, mouths, arrows, beetles, and birds, while red-brown deities with tails, wearing loincloths and brilliant armbands and collars, high crowns on their animal heads, and the cross ring of the symbol of life on their hands, laid a friendly touch on the shoulders of their earthly son. Joseph, a tiny figure among giants, gazed up at all this with calm young eyes. Young he was, and it was weighty with age. Yet he was aware that he opposed it with his youth, not only according to the measure of his years, but in a larger sense. He stiffened his back against the weight of the ages, and when he thought of the ancient crying by night with which the folk at the feast filled the courts of Bastet, he gave his shoulders a twitch.